Welcome to The Cherry Picker, the horror movie podcast where we like to kill people, sometimes for real. I'm your host, Zach Cherry, and with me is someone who has a quote that they want to get.
I know you gentlemen have been through a lot, but when you find the time, I'd rather not spend the rest of this winter tied to this fucking couch!
How did I know that that was going to be the quote?
Because that is the quote! That is the quote, in addition to, you gotta be fucking kidding. But that's too brief. Yeah.
I feel like that is a quote that has been used in so many movies since.
Yes.
But it's like originated in the thing. Who are you? Did you say your name? I don't remember.
Oh, Edward of Edward is Truth. Hi, folks. You know me. If you've heard this before, you know me.
And
if you haven't, welcome.
Yes. And today we are talking about John Carpenter's The Thing, which is celebrating its 40th birthday this week.
Older than The Thing.
That's very unfortunate.
I'm older than something encased in ice in the Antarctic.
That crash landed in the Antarctic, like back in the in the age of dinosaurs,
right?
Or whatever.
So
they
that's
figured.
How gives you a rough idea, folks, yeah. How old Edward is Truth is.
This was released June 25th, 1982. This is one of the best John Carpenter movies, probably the best. It's his favorite. He's gone on record to say that this is his favorite movie. This is one of my top five favorite horror movies. I'm way more on board with this movie. Not to say that I'm not on board with Halloween, but I mean, like, if it came down to The Thing and Halloween, I definitely would choose this over Halloween.
I'm just looking into space now, trying to, like, it's a Sophie's choice for me. I don't know which one I'd pick. Shall I do a synopsis?
Lead us in.
Before we dive in.
All
right. For anyone who hasn't seen it, lean in. A Norge helicopter pursues a fleeing sled dog until finally landing at an American research station in the Antarctic, where the two Norwegians on board manage to accidentally blow up their rotorcraft, shoot a member of the residing American team, and die before effectively communicating the reasons for their actions. The Americans take in the surviving Malamute and tend to their injured before departing to investigate the Norwegian base for answers. Once among the charred ruins and frozen corpses, they find the burned remains of a malformed humanoid, which they recover to the American station, ignorant to the fact that they've just invited in a creature that could absorb and replicate all life on Earth in a matter of years. Now left to doubt and question whether the identities of their own teammates have already been compromised, will this collection of engineers, scientists, and other service workers be able to survive and defeat The Thing?
I always I expect you to always leave it off on a question of just like The Thing. But very well done.
It doesn't sound like a trailer if you do it as a question. Like, you need to have finality at the end. You know what I mean?
But it's only it's just the beginning. I do like the unintentional sound effects of your cat mewing in the background.
I mean, she feels for the dogs. You know, she has empathy.
Mm-hmm. What's your first experience with the thing? What year did you first see it?
Probably circa 1983 or 84, when I had no memory, because I have no memory of my first screening of this. It was something that was just kind of always around. Maybe it was closer to like 85 or so, but I mean, I must have been like 4 or 5, and we had the VHS, and I popped it into, there is a VCR in this, isn't there? One of those,
there's a few. I think the one
Child's
that,
in.
Well, yeah, because they're watching the game shows in their room, and then later on when they're reviewing the Norwegian tapes.
Yes, and it's got one of those, like, I think I've mentioned it on the pod before, one of those rising drawers that you slide the VHS tape into.
Basically the same thing that he, like, does his dictation on with just, like, the smaller tape later on. It's just, like, a VCR version of that.
And I had one of those, too, one of those audio cassette little things with, like, all the buttons down at the bottom.
We all did,
Yeah, it was so much fun. I thought it was so, and it had a little handle so you could carry it around like a lunchbox. I thought it was so, like, chic. But I was the most en vogue, like, 5-year-old. But anyway, I remember I'd watch it often, and I just liked it. I remember I liked the grossness, and I liked just watching them. I don't even know if I could really compute what was going on, but I liked the fighting, and I liked the manic, you know, kind of like general chaos, level
the
of chaos that was
drama
going on. Even then, I gravitated towards the melodrama and the interaction, the interpersonal distrust and the get in your face. Well, then we're there, you know? I still can't tell what Keith David says exactly. Well, then we're there.
Oh, when they've locked.
What if we're wrong?
McCready.
Well, then we're wrong.
I think that's it. He's just like... Child, what if we're wrong? Well, then we're wrong.
He's so great. Yeah. I love Keith David in this movie.
Everyone in this movie, really.
No weak links as far as like actors.
Well,
we'll
see what happens when we get to the cherry picker. But
what about you?
So that's your first experience. Mine was, well, I used to work in a video store. And it was just like kind of like an afternoon job. I actually like volunteered there because I wasn't like legally old enough to work, like receive a paycheck or anything. So I was just like, I really want to like get work experience, and I really love like movies and stuff. And they're like, yeah, for sure. Like just come and like volunteer. You know, a few hours a week or something. So I would go down there and just like, of course, I gravitated towards the horror section. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was like a video. It was like a small video store. It wasn't like part of a big chain or anything, but they had like the aisles with like the shelves that went all the way up to the ceiling. And I would stand there like little me when I would have been like probably like 13 or 14.
Oh my God.
Like not little, but like medium me. And I would like be like, oh wow, like look up at everything. And I remember like seeing the case for this quite a few times. Because I'd already like it pops out at you because it's very pretty artwork, I have to say. I don't know who illustrated that, but kudos to them. But also just the fact that, you know, you see the name John Carpenter on there. And I was already familiar with John Carpenter because I had seen Halloween probably a million times at that point. I mean, at least 25 times. Like whenever we get to a pod about the original Halloween, like I'll have more of a story for that. But, you know, I had seen that movie quite a bit. But I hadn't really seen anything else John Carpenter at that point. So... I just like, this looks interesting. And at that point, like, it hadn't been, because this would have been the, right at the late 90s. And I don't think the thing had really gotten its big resurgence yet. I don't think that came until, like, DVDs had really hit the market. Like, they were just kind of starting to, trickle out at that time. So... I was like still discovering all these movies on VHS. And I saw this, the artwork for it, loved it. I also love the fact that I think because at that point I had seen Urban Legend and I like looked at it and it's just like, oh, it's just like the killer in Urban Legend on like the cover with like the parka, but like no distinguishable face.
No. I mean, in a manner of speaking, yeah. Like it's much more metaphoric.
I know it's metaphorical, but we're looking at movie art here. We're not looking at the movie. Yeah,
right. Yes.
And I mean, just being like a volunteer of like working here, I could like take home anything.
Oh, and, wow. That's so great.
Yeah, I was just like, okay, I took home like a new horror movie. Every night, like I would just go in every week and, or like every night almost, and be like, oh yeah, I'm gonna take this. And you know, it's their old movies, so they weren't like, like next day returns.
Right.
But I watched it and I don't even remember, like I couldn't like tell you like my memory of the first time. All I know is I just like immediately fell in love with it and it just like became one of my favorites. And I think it was at that point, because I, even like having just seen Halloween of John Carpenter's repertoire before that, I didn't really associate Halloween with John Carpenter. I mostly associated Halloween with Michael Myers. So it wasn't until like after I saw the thing that I was just like, okay, like John Carpenter, that's an important name that you have to remember now. And I think like from that point on, it was like, you know, cause this was still like very early in my introduction to horror. So it's, I'm glad that that was one of the first movies that I did get to see. And yeah. I mean like not one of the first, but I mean like earlier on, obviously. And I'm glad that, you know, it did. Cause I like that, having that appreciation for John Carpenter then segues into, you know, having an appreciation for Wes Craven and George Romero and Dario Argento and all those
filmographies. Of particular directors. Absolutely.
Because I mean, you're not just watching movies based on like a franchise that they're in or like a subgenre, but the other works of the person who made that. So
absolutely.
John Carpenter was definitely like the first. I mean, I think that I'd probably heard Wes Craven before, because like Scream was so big at the time with like Scream and Scream 2 right after that. But I just like, I didn't know anything. Like Wes Craven just sounded like a very demonic name to me. So I just like pictured this like evil, like devil, like director making these horror movies.
Absolutely.
Lo and behold, he's like this like sweet, old, English professor.
And same with John Carpenter for me. Like, I remember first time I heard the name, it had impact. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of like, because I think I heard it in like that trailer voice that I do with the synopses in.
Yeah.
Just like, John Carpenter. And maybe I saw a trailer for Halloween before I ever saw the movie. And I remember seeing his name over, you know, titles of things that were in the video store also. And I remember thinking like, oh, he's a big deal because his name is over the title. His name wouldn't be over the title if he weren't important. And just, the weight that it carried. And then again, like in a very kind of like turn of fate, you see an interview with John Carpenter and he's anything but scary. I mean, he's a little gruff, but he's mostly just kind of tired.
Yeah. he does have I love like, because he just tells it like it is. Like, he doesn't hold back.
Yeah.
We should all know at this point, like, his opinions on the Halloween remake and Rob Zombie. Right. And, and for anyone who doesn't know, he was, like, at a convention and someone asked him what he thought about it. And he's just like, it wasn't my vision for it. Like, you know, he was trying to mince words and be nice, but then he's like, but you know, I did see this like retrospective that they did that we were all involved in. And he lied about me. Like, they interviewed Rob Zombie and he said something about John Carpenter that according to John Carpenter wasn't true. So he's just like, that kind of changed my perception of who he is. So, just because I think he's an asshole now and I didn't like his movie at all. So, but I love that about him, that he's just like, he is very crotchety, very, very cantankerous. And I just like, he's the kind of person, like, it's just like, I don't have any living grandparents, but like, and I don't think I ever met any of my grandfathers, but I could just see someone like John Carpenter. I would like, I wish that was my grandfather. Cause you'd just be like, I want to go hang out with grandpa. Cause he has all these good stories and he probably like curses and just says like, he's got all the good tea and he just says shit about people. But the thing like with John Carpenter, especially that I really appreciate about him in interviews is that he's able to criticize himself. Like he's just like, yeah, we did this movie. It was a piece of shit. I don't like, you know, like he can look at the thing and just be like, this is my favorite movie, but he can also look at Memoirs of an Invisible Man and be like what
thank
the
God.
Fuck was I thinking? Like, why did
thank
that happen?
Thank God he's, yeah. Yeah, and thank God that he's not pretending that that's like a valid piece of art that he made. Yeah. But and that's not dissing him, it's dissing just the movie and the whole story, but which maybe one day we'll get into.
I think like the thing with him is the like, because he's very much an artist, you know, when it comes to directing, but he's also a producer. He's also a businessman. So he's kind of, he's gotten to a point where it's like balancing the two and, you know, what is more beneficial to him. And certainly like earlier in his career, it was more so about the filmmaking aspect of it and the art that he put into it, because this was a movie that like he probably did his best work on the thing. And it was also at the time critically panned, not just by critics, but also like audiences. Like it bombed at the box office. It's like I said, like even like 15 years later, that's the time that it was just like starting to, or more than 50, like 17 years later, like really starting to find its cult following, or at least like having its cult following grow larger. Yeah. So, you know, I think this was the beginning of the end for him in terms of just like that cynical attitude that he had towards Hollywood, because every movie that he did after this, when it goes to like Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, They Live, all that, it was just like increasingly just getting shat on more and more by Hollywood, that he's just like, this isn't fun anymore, until he found out that just like, oh, I can make even more money by just having my name attached to something. And he's at a point now in his life where it's just like, yeah, he like sits at home and he watches basketball and plays video games and probably smokes like a shit ton of pot and collects paychecks. And he's like having the best time ever. He might like come and do a score for a new movie here and there.
Yeah, right.
But he knows
the man has nothing. He has nothing left to prove either. Yeah. I mean, I would love to see him if he felt passionate about something, to see his name attached to something that he's at the helm of and that, you know, wants to like put out there, regardless of like what my opinion of it might be afterwards. Mm-hmm. I would still love to see just, you know, I love seeing that kind of passion, but also I understand like, It's been a lot of years, you know, like it's been a lot of effort already building this filmography that we're referring to that I don't require anymore. I'll take whatever else you have to give me. But if this is what, you know, what you've got, you're one of the most famous names in the lexicon of the horror genre.
And I don't just even like in standing franchises. Well, the last movie he directed was something called The Ward. It came out in 2010. I've seen it. I don't remember it at all. It stars Amber Heard.
Oh, all right.
But that's like just like, you know, back when she was still getting movie roles. And I couldn't tell you what that was about. Like the last movie that I don't even think that was released theatrically, but I believe it was Ghosts of Mars. That was like the last one that was like early 2000s. And I don't, that's another movie. Like I kind of remember it, but there's a lot that I don't. So I just like his career was like, there was a trajectory of where it was going. And he was just like, yeah, this is, I don't want to like make mediocre films. I mean, not to say, I shouldn't say anything about this because I haven't seen them in a while, but it's kind of like, yeah, I'm going to like hang up my hat, you know. And then like, you know, you have other people like on the reverse of that, Wes Craven, who was, you know, working basically like up until his death. I mean, like Scream 4 was the last of what he did, and that was 4 years before. But I mean, even then, he was still working regularly enough that, you know, every couple of years there was a new movie coming out, and they did well. I mean, like, people knew that there was a new Wes Craven movie coming out, so.
It's also worth mentioning that, like, these directors, even though they're at the helm, they are not in control of every aspect of the films that they are making.
Yeah.
Like, a miracle like Halloween for John Carpenter to have as much control and to defer to as many people who seemed to share a mutual respect with him while they were making that, like, you know, Deborah Hill and,
Was Deborah Hill involved in The Thing? I don't think they were.
No, I think by the time they reached The Thing, they were kind of on the outs. I don't recall seeing her name in the.
It wasn't there at all. I've never seen her come up in any interviews about it. I believe The Fog was kind of like their last, maybe Escape from New York, because that would have come out before this. But but, you know, we still had Dean Cundey. He's
love
here.
You, Dean Cundey.
He's in this or
so good.
Working on it.
Yes.
But that's, you bring up a really good point, because like that early in his career, he did have, like, he was able to gain full creative control on these movies and have his name appear above each movie title. And I mean, that's something that he kind of retained throughout the rest of his career, at least like having that credit. But clearly, like, the control was like slowly relinquished over time, that, you know, you do get into the late 90s and early 2000s, and those were probably more so studio films with vampires and Ghosts of Mars. So, I mean, it just sounds to me like he kind of got out, I don't want to say at a good time, but he, like, knew, like, when to just, like, quit.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's a business, and at a certain point, I'm sure a studio just sees you as something that they'll make them more money. Like, if, oh, we could put your name over the title because you're that guy who directed that other thing. Okay, awesome. We're more than happy to do that. Here's your money and here's the rules. Okay, now we're going to change the rules and we don't like this ending. And you know what? We don't like this leading lady. Reshoot everything and put a new leading lady in.
Yeah.
or something like that. But with this movie in particular, though, like, it's so funny to me because most people, I think, I constantly forget how it begins. I always remember the Malamute running, you know, the Malamute slash wolf hybrid that it was running across.
I would have just said husky. I don't know.
The like husky. Dog breeds. But no, IMDb said it, and you know, they never lie. So so we'll just say the dog, the sled dog, just like running around.
Jed
across the,
is the name of the,
Jed.
In real
yes,
life, just, Jed the dog is the actor's credit.
We love Jed. But Jed just like running across like the snow. And just because I think it's also maybe a little more impactful because it's also, I get emotionally connected to the dog every single time. For some reason, I know it's The Thing. And I'm still watching it as this like vulnerable thing being shot at from a helicopter up above. Like, you know, like the helicopter's being driven by Sarah Palin or somebody. But just my sympathy is always with the dog. And I always forget that it begins with that ship from like the 2001 Space Odyssey shot, you know, like crashing.
I mean, that's more of a prologue sort of thing. Cause you know, even then I was watching it last night and I forgot like exactly like sequentially, like how the credits played out. I was like thinking like, oh, the credits, does it go like keep cutting back to like the black screen with the credits, like during the chase with the dog? And even though I forget, I don't think they did that. I think that was something that was in the remake or not the remake, sorry, the prequel. but with this movie, it's, and what I think is so great about this story and like just like the whole narrative from start to finish is that the movie starts as it's happening in the middle of the story and we aren't given like any information. We're just seeing what's happening and we have to slowly figure that out over time. And even as I was watching, I was looking at the runtime and it was like already 15 minutes in by the time I think they were kind of had shot the Norwegian or Gary had shot him and they were just like trying to assess the situation and be like, we've got to fly out to the Norwegian camp and see what's up. They're just like, oh, wow. Like, I don't remember like my memory of this movie is like it moves along very quickly, and there's nothing wrong with the pacing as you're watching it, but it just like the reliance on coming into the story and not having the information and just kind of like going into it and just being absorbed into it as it happens is such a good technique that you don't see in a lot of movies. And I was even thinking about this because I, you know, jumping back to Halloween for a second, because I was watching it with the commentary last October between John Carpenter and Jamie Lee Curtis. And she was actually bringing up, she's like, wow, like, look how long you held that shot for. Like, yes. That's really impressive. And he's like, yeah, and I wouldn't be able, like, I would never be able to do that today. Like, studios just want you to, like, rush and rush and rush things. And that's, like, the beauty of his work here and in Halloween. But you just see, like, that he knows what shots to hold and how long to hold it for, because he knows that, like, nobody's going to notice that. Nobody's going to notice that we've been, like, focusing on something for 30 seconds of runtime here.
Nobody's going to check their watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're building towards something. Mm-hmm. And that's also where the artistry comes in. And it's all, even beyond that, it's almost like a time-based architecture, you know, like you need to, or even just like, because the reason why he is so good at that is because he's also a composer, and it's all about like, you know, deciding what note to hit and when, and that, and I think that's why, I think that's why this is going to turn out to be just like a Halloween pod. But I think that's why that movie works so well, because I remember them saying like they screened it with like no score and it was incredibly boring. And then you put in the score and all of a sudden the movie's happening. And oftentimes we've criticized particular moments in other films, not even John Carpenter films, where I'm like, you know what? I could have done with a track here. Like the silence, no tension. I need, like, you know, John Carpenter laced in, or Ennio Morricone, or, you know, like, and you know, composers.
Well, this
like
is,
that.
This is Ennio Morricone.
I know.
Just in case. I know you know, but just for anyone else. So, yeah, this is one of the rare instances where John Carpenter doesn't score his his own film. And, I mean, like, I love this score. Yes. And there's so much of it that, like, didn't make it into the movie. So you have to like have the album. I actually have the, well, the one behind me is the Lost Cues, from John Carpenter, but you know, I have I have like the score proper, and you know, I love listening to that one. Like Ennio Morricone, RIP, scored so many great and memorable, not just like horror films, but just like movies in general, like a lot of Westerns as well. And there
and
is a very
works for this movie.
Yeah, yes, there's a very Western vibe about this that I do love.
Well, because the introduction of MacReady, played by Kurt Russell, just the fact that like he's playing, you know, this automated chess and drinking J&B, you know, during the daylight, because you know who gives a shit. And I love that he's already kind of like grizzled. He's got a full on like cowboy-esque hat that he wears like throughout the movie. But I love that the way he's introduced, we learn basically like two things about him, is that he doesn't like to lose. And also that he's just generally, I mean, I just generally get this kind of like renegade, very cowboy-esque feel from him. Like this guy who's obviously like he's a sharpshooter, but he doesn't always win. But even if he doesn't win, he's going to change the rules and find a way to win, you know, like, and because the men, for the most part of the facility seem to regard him as a figure of authority, when the only thing we really know about him is that he's the helicopter pilot, right? Like, is there anything
he's the pilot, or like at least like the first in command pilot, because, Palmer is also a pilot, because there's a bit where, because you know, he's has his joint, he's like, oh shit, doc, I'll take you out, and he's just like, don't even think about it, and he's like, oh gee, thanks for asking, any or thanks for thinking about me,
right?
So I think like those are the only two, which kind of like makes, and okay, we'll get into this later, because I don't want to get too much into who infected who timeline just yet, because I think they're, because I am interested in your theories and opinions on that, but going back to just like all of the characters, there's definitely a pecking order. It's not entirely clear, but obviously Gary's kind of like, he's, I don't know if he's like the most important like VIP figure, but he's like the one who's managing everything. Mm-hmm. And then it just seems like the scientists, like the your Blair and your Dr. Copper, like they're obviously higher up as well. And then right. Fuchs is kind of like their underling
or yes.
Yeah, because he's always like, I know I need their help. Like we can't do it. And they're just like
I can't do this without
you're gonna have to. And then I think that it basically it goes down the pecking order and Windows is at the very bottom. Windows is like I feel so bad for him. And I think we might have talked about this before. But I always like I always bring this up. Windows is like just in terms of like who's kind of like the bitch of the movie, or as I like to call them, the Meg Griffin of the movie. And Windows is just that one character that everyone shits on. Yeah. They're so mean to him, and I feel so sorry for him. Like even the fact that when MacReady is like he's kind of taken over the situation later on, and he's getting like tying everyone up and everything, he gets Windows to assist him. Because he probably looks at Windows as just being the most, like, meager, pathetic person that if he did turn out to be the thing, it'd just be like, I can easily take care of him. So I'll have him be, like, the one that I can, like, trust more easily to assist me because I just know that he won't try anything if he is human.
Easy to overpower.
Yeah. But I like so he's one of my favorites. Like I just like I just like
I love watching him. Yeah, he's got my sympathy for sure because nobody wants to be Windows in any situation.
Yeah.
Especially when like Palmer's shitting all over him or like pointing the finger and accusing him and everything. Like that's just mean-spirited. But I love one of the things, okay, because we're just in terms of first impressions, we talked about MacReady, but my first impression of Gary, before we even really know that he's in charge, or, you know, I mean, that I always perceived him to be the one who's assigned, you know, the chief position, but...
He's the key holder.
Yeah, but he's also... What I love about him, and I love Donald Moffat as an actor, and I love the way he plays him, but and the, one of the things that I love that he plays in... the character, and I don't even know if it's scripted this way, if every actor who played that role would play it this way, but he plays a real leader in that he's the kind of person who knows when he needs to defer to somebody else. He knows when it's best to step aside, and it's not all about being bullheaded or being, you know, like, just like, you know, strong, making your will stronger than everybody else's so you can control them. It's all about, okay, I can't have mass hysteria here. If it's going to make everybody calm down, I will step down and put somebody else in charge. And we literally watch that happen like in real time on screen. And I find that to be an actually pretty admirable leadership role that doesn't oftentimes get pronounced or focused on with figures in power in horror movies or even in action movies or you know whatever other kind of like assignment you want to give this.
And I mean, I especially feel because at that point, there's so many people who aren't in charge who are kind of taking charge. Like for example, Childs, who's just like coming in all like hot headed, and I remember Clark, because he takes out his switchblade and he's like hell, and you got MacReady. It's just like maybe someone a little more even tempered.
It's so shitty. It's such a shitty thing to say to someone.
Yeah.
But you love. What do you love? But
like every single one of these, because I mean, this is a large cast and all males, and again, like you can't always distinguish between them because they're wearing like big parkas and like winter gear, but I just know who every single one of them is. I remember their names, like all 12 of them. They each have a very distinct personality. I actually think they could probably assign like a zodiac sign to each and every one of them that is different. But what I like is that they, because like we were saying, it's almost like it's the like the politics and the like the social aspect of it. And I kind of look at this as like this is like the horror movie equivalent of like the reality show Big Brother, where you've got 12 people who are locked inside this facility for like for the entire season, and it's like little by little, like each one is going to be extinguished until the only two remain, and then it'll come down to a vote about which one of them is human still.
Right. Do you have one? Because you mentioned the Zodiac, and we always bring that up. But I mean, even if it's just in private conversations, I don't know how often we've covered that in the pod.
We talk about this. Yeah, we talk about Zodiac.
Do we? Because okay,
we talked about it with 13 Ghosts.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. The Dark Zodiac.
Yeah.
But with this one, I'm not going to ask you, I mean, unless you want to share like who you think is the Zodiac, you know, represents like which men, but is there somebody who's like kind of your window, into this movie that you feel like you identify with most, whether they're Scorpio or not? Like, is there somebody you're just kind of like, that's probably who I'd be? Really?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, I feel that like we... There's like character traits of like certain people that you see, but I mean like by and large we're really following MacReady's story, and there are moments where we kind of leave him, like, you know, when Knowles comes back and he's like, I cut him loose, and we don't really know what's going on with him at that point, or if we can trust him, because we did see the tattered pajamas with his name on them. Yeah. But it's really hard to, like, you can definitely, like, pick up on, like, how people would react, but we don't really see how people would, like, proact. Is that a word? I don't know. In the situation, other than, like, MacReady, because he's really the only one that's kind of being proactive in the situation. And okay. I think he's a Taurus.
The bull.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, yeah. And especially like sense. And especially at the beginning with the playing the chess game and being like, fuck this. I mean, that could be any sign.
That's hilarious.
But all he wants to do is like go up to his shack and get drunk, you know? It's just like I just need to relax. Like, that's
right. There's
very,
no rush.
Very Taurian.
I'm in the
freaking
Antarctic, for crying out loud. But see, for me, I feel like I think the one who there are traits. Like, I mean, I already mentioned like with Gary, how I admire that quality in a leader. And I think if I were leading any kind of group of any number of people, regardless of, you know, their gender identity or whatever, I feel like I would probably want to have the presence of mind to know, okay, if all y'all don't trust me, that's fine. I'm going to step off. I'm not going to try to to take back the power and try to like get y'all going. So I admire that. But I also really, really love Childs, because I feel like without Childs in this movie, MacReady would just have full free reign for the most part. I mean, he kind of does anyway.
Yeah.
But for every MacReady, you need a Childs to push back against him without letting him have the absolute power. I like that about him. Mm-hmm. That's why I love that they're the last two, not standing, but sitting, reclining in the end of the movie. But,
because they're biggest adversaries throughout.
Yeah. And if
he basically, he was going to let him, he was going to, even if he was human or not, it's just like, he was going to let him, I was going to let him freeze.
Yeah. Yes, right.
But if so I, what if he if is?
I've had adversarial connections with people before too. I've had that dynamic with people who try to pull shit with me, and I know what it is to, I can feel the necessity to push back and let them know. But honestly, I think the one who I probably identify with the most, and it's really sad, is Fuchs, because he's just trying to do what's right.
Yeah.
He's gathering information. He's trying to look at the facts, but he also doesn't have a problem kind of like being told what to do if he respects who's in charge. That is largely me. So.
And I would peg him as the Virgo. So
he's totally the Virgo. Look at
such the Virgo.
And even just his reaction when MacReady walks in to, like, just kind of, like, check in on him. He's like, you know, like, what the fuck? Turn around and look at him like, I was just going over these documents. You know, like, giving him, like, this incredible suspicious look. Yeah. And I really appreciate that as well.
While we're on the topic of Fuchs, like, because I was sad that, you know, he got such a... I mean, his send-off was kind of anticlimactic, if we could say, because he just disappears. And then they find, like, the charge maybe remains or whatever. And then they're just like, maybe it got to him, or maybe he, like, burned himself before it did. Like, it's just, like, I don't like that, like, inconclusiveness to it. But there was an alternate version that was filmed where they find him, Palmer and Childs go off into this like greenhouse section of the facility that we hadn't seen before. Shit. And I don't know if it was like where he was like growing his marijuana in there or something. Cause there's like all these plants. I don't know if that was what it was supposed to be, but they like close the door and Fuchs is pinned to the door with like a shovel, like impaled into him. So for whatever reason that was not used in the finished version, and it only exists in like stills at this point.
Oh man, that's sad. I really like that actor too, Joel Polis. He worked a lot through the 80s and the 90s, and
not so
he was
much
on
anymore.
A lot of television shows that I watched. Not so much anymore. Yeah. I mean, I can look. I don't know if he's got like any recent credits. He's still around, but you know, he was on Seinfeld. He played Riley.
who's Riley?
I don't know. It just says Riley. Oh, it looks like he was in something called. He was in some a bunch of shorts. Okay, so it looks like he works for just kind of the love of it these days. Good for him, because I mean, he made bank back in the day, so hopefully he, you know, invested really wisely. I also I want to talk about Blair.
Let's talk about Blair. Let's talk about Wilford Brimley.
Wilford Brimley.
Diabetes Brimley.
Diabetes. But and was it Quaker Oats? I can't remember.
I don't know.
He advertised for some kind of like oatmeal, and I can't remember if it was Quaker back in the day. It's been too long. But the commercials are on YouTube if anybody's curious, and you can see he always looks like that. He's just a little bit wider hair, but I want to see baby photos of Wilford Brimley.
Yeah, he was one of those people exactly who like was just like he was already like geriatric before. It was like the Robin Williams Jack syndrome where he was actually 32 years old when they filmed the thing.
Oh my god, and he looks like 20 years older than that.
No, I don't know. I was making that up. I was just being
hyperbolic. Oh, okay. I thought you were being sincere.
I mean, I'll look to see like what his actual age.
Okay, because yeah, just a few years later in Cocoon, he played a senior citizen, like a full fledged senior citizen. So I'd be surprised if he was, you know,
also
anything less than like late 40s.
Yeah, RIP to him. 2020, very recently. He was born in 1934. Let me just do the math here.
Because I can't. 52? No, 48?
48, yeah.
Okay. Late 40s. I'll buy it. But yeah, no, he, okay. And also just like an American treasure, like a national treasure is Wilford Brimley. Cause he's also just one of those actors who it never looks like he's acting. He's just kind of like, and this is not putting down any of the other actors. They do great jobs, but Wilford Brimley and everything I've ever seen him, I just feel like he's talking, like he's not reading lines off of a page that he's memorized. You know, he's just kind of sitting there going, no, I'm just talking to you. I'm just talking through, you know, my big, you know,
mustache.
Upper lip hanging over my big mustache. And, but I just, I love the fact that he's introduced as a figure of authority also, but also he's the one who really seems to kind of like be absorbing the impact emotionally and psychologically the most. Even before he goes off his rocker, the clues are planted there when he's like uncovering these masses within masses.
I love his like his reaction. He's like, oh
yeah,
gross.
Which is also incredible acting because apparently, again, I got this on IMDb trivia, but apparently, allegedly, he was the only member of the cast who, when they were digging through, like, because they were actual human. Or I don't know about human organs, but actual animal organs that they were using, and not human organs. That would have been something, but actual animal organs that they were like digging through to like kind of, you know, make it look even more authentic. And he was the only one who didn't retch once or have any kind of like, you know, reaction to what he was doing when they were, you know, rehearsing. So all of that he's doing is just him acting, but also it seemed to be not just like gross, but also just like loss, you know, like feeling like a genuine sense of, oh, the humanity, like what am I beholding? And then later when he's just sitting there looking at the photograph of the Norwegian team after they come back from their base.
Yeah.
And he's just looking at it with a sense of foreboding. And isn't he straddling? But he's like, not straddling, but I mean, you know what I mean? Like looking at that, but also looking at the computer screen to find out like what's the fate, like what's the chance of like infection among, you know, the like all of the people on my own base. And oh my God. And you can just see it registering like in his face. He's just mulling things over and he is not at ease. And there's this general morose sense of like impending doom. So it makes total sense when he just starts smashing things and shooting and threatening poor Windows in the corner.
I don't know how much sense it makes. I mean, not that I'm saying that anything is nonsensical here, but just like from a human standpoint, like I can't condone of that irrational behavior. There's like, because that's why I follow more so like MacReady's like entry point into things, because he is being a little bit more pragmatic about the situation and you know the potentiality of survival. Whereas Blair's already kind of like, well, fuck this and fuck all of you, but without like really, I mean, it's just like, if you're going to do that, if you're going to do what you're doing, do it discreetly. Don't go in there and be like, I'll kill you.
But I mean, that's the thing. I don't mean that it is a sensible choice on his part, but I do mean that it just makes absolute sense that the character who is not, because at least even MacReady, even though he's not really... He is having exchanges with people about various members of the team about what needs to be done, but he's also kind of like musing about it, like with that tape recorder, that audio cassette, like just going over like, you know, things and letting the hopelessness out. And if you're just cycling it out, if you're getting it away from you, it can't fester, you know, it can't like do damage.
And that should be
all Blair is doing is absorbing it.
That should, because I've heard a lot of people say that they, you know, MacReady was a thing, or he, you know, was a thing all along, or you know, whatever. But I mean, the fact that he is recording, like keeping a record of what's going on, should be indication enough. Yeah. Showing us that he is a reliable narrator, and you know, we can trust and believe him. Even like, you know, when he says later on, just like, no, I'll show you all what I already know. And he says that kind of again, like when they're burning the blood bags, and he's just like, I know I'm human, and I know that some of you are still too, because if all of you were, then you would be attacking me right now. Yes, and actually, this is a good segue into kind of like, what do you make anything of like an infection timeline? Because I did do a long time ago, Who Killed Who of the Thing. I hadn't actually watched this video, I still haven't since I made it, but I watching the movie over again last night kind of like reminded me of like certain things that I did connect with that made it seem like, okay, this is what I think happened. Because I know like a lot of what John Carpenter did in the movie, like especially when we see the silhouette at the beginning when the dog walks into the room, which was actually Dick Warlock, who played Michael Myers in Halloween 2. But it was like he wanted to get like a silhouette of someone who actually wasn't an actor in the movie, just to make it seem very
vague.
Vague of just like who it could be, even though the silhouette to me looks very much like I remember everyone's names. Norris with the Betsy Palmer sweater and the curly hair.
Even the Betsy Palmer hair, arguably. But and with the chest teeth. In answer to your question, I feel like I have more clarity about who isn't infected as I move through it, just based off of like, you know, like here you're talking about MacReady with his recording of the tapes. I feel like I knew before they tested Clark's blood after MacReady shot him in, it was the head, right?
Yeah.
And they were testing his blood, and Childs tells him like, yeah, it makes you a murderer. And Keith David is the most fun to do impressions of, though. Maybe that is my trailer voice. It's just Keith David being awesome, but he's amazing. But I feel like with Clark, like all the clues there. I mean, I remember just the look that Blair gave him when they were taking the dog's blood to like perform the test to make sure that they're still okay and everything like that, and the way he was looking at him. I I don't think I ever suspected Clark, because I never suspected that the thing would be able to emote the way he is.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, because we even see that when Blair kills the dogs, and it, like, I think, like, the last shot before the transition to the next day or whatever is him kind of grieving over the, like, you just see the dog in the foreground with the accident. So it's just like, he is, like, he does emote a lot of empathy that you could definitely, there, by process of elimination, you can rule out a lot of people for sure. And I think that's kind of your window into kind of figuring it out. But I always figured that the first one infected and the silhouette that we see, even though it's supposed to be any of them, just in terms of the silhouette, but I, like, logically, I think that that's Norris.
Me too.
Because at that point, because there's a lot of things that, like the silhouette John Carpenter put in the movie to kind of I don't know if he did it intentionally to paint, like, a timeline for anyone, if they were paying attention, but more so just to put it there to create paranoia in them. And we see this in, Palmer and Childs when they're sharing the joint. Because that could be a source of infection right there. And that had already happened after the dog had wandered into the room. So that at least tells us that if Palmer was already affected, because we know that he's affected later on at the blood test, that Childs would have been affected too. But we know that Childs isn't affected or infected, sorry. So that would leave, because the only other person there could be was Blair. But with, what am I saying, with Norris, he later goes to the excavation site with MacReady and Palmer. So it's the three of them. So if Palmer was already infected at that point, like MacReady says later on, like, if everyone that I was with was infected too, you would have attacked them. So just, we know that at that point, Palmer wouldn't have been infected, and Norris would have been the only one infected when they went to the excavation site.
Very good.
And then when they came back, and that was right before, I guess, like, this was before, like, Blair had his blow up. But the reason why I don't think that Blair is infected yet at that point, not only for the fact that he's basically trying to destroy the facility to make sure that it doesn't get out, but when they do lock him up in the whatchamacallit, in the cabin, or the shack, is that they leave his bottle, I think it's vodka, I can't remember what it was, with him.
It was vodka, Smirnoff.
But before MacReady leaves the cabin, he takes a swig of that bottle and then puts it down, and we'd already seen Blair drinking from it earlier, so that would mean that MacReady would have been infected too. So it's just like, it kind of shows, that's why I think that Blair didn't become infected until, like, after, like, either Norris or Palmer would have gone and infected him when they went to bring him food or something like that. Because there is, like, time does jump around here, because there's the scene where he's like, there's a storm coming in a few hours. And then, like, when he's doing his dictation in the next scene, he's like, storm's been hitting us hard for 48 hours. So you can kind of, like, get a sense for, how much time has passed, at least, even though it's just at a certain point, it seems like it's always, like, darkness. Like, there is no more daylight. So it's all, like, one continuous night.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, nights are probably longer in the Antarctic anyway, too.
But,
I mean, it does feel like an endless night. But I agree with you as far as, like, definite. I mean, everything that you've said. But as far as Norris in particular, another thing that, like, has me absolutely convinced that silhouette is Norris is the fact that there are two reaction shots that follow. I think the first one is when they bring the remains back to Station 4. And there's just one shot. I think it has all the men, or not all the men, but a bunch of men in it. But Norris is kind of like the central figure, and he's just standing there looking, I don't know, concerned or suspicious or, just something. Like, there's something, if you're looking for it, it could just be a man going, oh my God, what is that? Mm-hmm. But it could be also like, oh, they're uncovering. That means, I'm not going to be able to fly under the radar because they're actually finding out that, some shit happened.
Yeah. Well, because, like, I made that because I didn't look specifically for that, or at least this last time I was watching it. But because when I made this video, of course, like, you know, you have a lot of people chime in and they bring up a lot of theories that are kind of bullshit or not. Not to say that not to say that my perception of how things is like the be all end all one. But there's a lot of things that come up that I don't necessarily agree with. I mean, one of them is the you can't see the steam coming off of your breath in the thing, because they say that at the end when the two of them are sitting there, that you know that what's his face Childs is the thing because you can't see his breath. You can though, if like maybe that was back in like DVD days, but I like you can see it. It's just because like of the position of where he is from the light, it's not as visible. But this is debunked by the fact that like when Bennings is transforming and they're all standing around him.
Yes,
and we already know that at that point, Palmer's probably infected and Norris is definitely infected. You can see their breath in the cold air.
Yeah.
So you can write that off. That is not a thing.
Yeah.
There's also like the glimmer in the eye, or just like the light that they've mentioned is that, you know, when you know that if you can't see the reflection of light in their eye, it's because that they're the thing. But we definitely, because like in that one shot right before,
like the replicants from Blade Runner,
like right before Palmer kind of reveals himself before the blood test thing, you don't see any light in his eyes. But in that scene, like right before that, as they're going past everyone, you can. So I know in the one of the commentaries they mentioned that like they might have tried to do it as sort of like a camera trick to you know make it in the moment like kind of telling, but
a discovery. Right?
Yeah, it's not something that you can use as canon throughout the movie to decipher. Oh well, they're this person and they're that, and then another thing is they're saying, well, like the dog had already infected Bennings at the beginning because it came and like ran up, and they're like, well, why wouldn't he just lick him right then and there?
It was licking his face, right?
Well, it didn't lick it. It didn't actually lick his face.
I mean, it was trying.
But I think the thing that I take into consideration, and like, even though the movie, like the 2011 movie, isn't canon at this point, the events that happen in it are. So like you're saying of just like Norris in that situation, discovering like when they bring the thing back and it's just like, what are we going to do? Clearly the thing has already evolved at that point and gathered intel from their last experience at the Norwegian camp that they know like, okay. And I mean, it's been a while since I've watched that movie as well, but I seem to recall it being a little bit more frenetic in terms of like it was more maybe fast paced and like, you know, once shit started happening, because there was a lot of characters in that movie and people were like getting killed left, right, and center. So I feel that like the thing was maybe a little bit more impulsive during the Norwegian camp experience, that like now coming to the American camp, they're like, okay, I'm gonna need to lie low and do this slowly, like just assimilate one at a time rather than just like making my presence known outwardly right away.
Like maybe there were just less people in confined spaces together, you know, at any given time. Maybe they were much more separate, and maybe that's why the thing went.
Well, because they even
on the Norge,
Because but they even say like, well, Blair, when he's just like, how long were you alone with that dog? And he's like, you know, an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So it could have infected him at that point, but it chose not to. So it's just like that's how smart this being is, that they're able to like look at people and be like, no, I think my best entry point, like they probably looked at Clark and was just like, I don't know if he's like a good one to infect because he seems to be lower on the totem pole. Whereas someone like Norris might have been like, you know, he's a scientist, or I forget like his exact role within the team.
I have a theory about that, actually. I've always thought like the reason they didn't infect Clark was because they knew that as himself, he was conditioned, or that he had some kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for? Reflexive, kind of impulse. That's what I'm looking for to protect the dogs.
Yeah.
So if you can just get me into another space, like you've been taking good care of me. Okay. I need to keep you in the running, because if somebody tries to get rid of me or tries to do something, that's probably the next person I should infect, because I need to protect myself. I always thought that's what it was.
Oh, so you're saying that they didn't infect him because as a human, he was going to be protecting them regardless.
He was helpful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Helpful.
Okay. No, that makes sense. Yeah, I like that.
Oh, Can I also just say, like, we're talking about the thing now and its intentions, and I love that. Because I feel like that's something that doesn't get, like, discussed enough in this movie, because it's all, I mean, it's the big bad, and we all know that it's, you know, it's this virus that we're passing around, and we all need to, like, you know, like, and you know, all these other motifs that you can bring up sociologically about, like, what it could mean about the other and how we treat them and stuff. But what I love about the thing as an entity of, in and of itself is, I think the thing is hilarious as number one, I love that two instances where I absolutely adore the thing trying to play human are when they're trying to decide who's going to be in charge and they try to pass it to Norris and the thing has obviously already, you know, overtaken and replicated Norris. Yeah. So the thing is just like looking around like, guys, honestly, I don't feel up to it. You know, it's just this really socially awkward, but like not impassioned, not connected, like thing that should have made him actually suspect. But also because he wasn't at the forefront of anything that had really happened up until then, we had two reaction shots. We had the one I mentioned and another, I think, while the dog, the you know, the scene where the dog was in the pen and it was attacking all the other dogs. There's another shot, I think, when they are shooting at the thing dog.
Yeah.
And you just see Norris's reaction to it, you know, looking kind of horrified at what he's seeing. And again, contextually, for the first time, you can just think, oh, the horror. But
and you don't know what, like, John Carpenter's, like, direction to them might have been. Just like, just, yeah, just look scared. Like, they might know, like, am I the thing already? And he's just like,
but
don't
it,
even think about it.
It works.
Just, yeah. Just,
Just act. I can see John Carpenter, too.
I imagine him telling Nick Castle, just like, so do you, how do you want me to, like, walk across the lawn here? Just like, just walk. Just walk, like... Don't waste my time with these questions.
Yeah. I don't know. Just
figure
do what feels right.
Yeah.
You're the actor. Yeah. Act.
Yeah.
So I love that little Norris moment. I also just love the look on when they're doing the blood testing sequence. When Palmer is just sitting there, and they're just kind of like, all right, now we're going to do Palmer next. And you just see his face just kind of like, well, I guess this is it.
Yeah, it's a kind of like a look of defeat. And just like... We had a good
just
run.
Like, all right. It's now or never. Yeah. I mean, I'll wait and see. I mean, I'm sure I know what the reaction is going to be, but I can't reveal myself until the last possible moment. Yeah. And I thought it was hilarious.
I also love, like, kind of everyone's reactions to it, really. Like, and you know, you especially see that with Nulls, because this is after Palmer has already revealed himself and been incinerated, that he's afraid. And this is like, created more speculation that people think that, you know, as the thing, you don't actually realize that you're the thing, because he's like terrified. It's just like, what if I am, you know, cause that's what I'm reading off of his face in the moment. Cause it's just like, if the same thing happens when, you know, we put the hot needle into my blood that it did for Palmer, like I'm going to get torched right here. So, you know, you especially see that, like, it just like whatever, everyone's like playing it in like, in such a unique way that, it, you know, there's definitely something to bring up in that matter. Is like, does the thing operate as a hive mind, or is each entity sort of kind of out for themselves? You know, like would Palmer be willing to like sell Norris up the stream to further his own? Cause I assume that they're all like the same organism and just kind of splintering off into different cells.
I would too, in a sense. I feel like they're all interconnected, certainly by, you know, like this, would you call it genetic? I don't even know. Just like this almost amoebic kind of like, you know, quality to them. Like their chemistry, obviously, like they're all the same family and all of that. But I also feel like there is some kind of agency that, you know, is allotted to each individual person. I don't think there's like one thing, hive mind, residing somewhere that is like kind of like interconnected with all this other stuff and feels the pain every time. I feel like that's all speculation. I don't feel like MacReady really has a firm grip. He's still kind of making things up, like things that seem like they would make the most sense at any given point. My cat is going crazy. Hey, you're fine. I'm right here. You can see me. Anyway, sorry, folks.
I think that, well, I mean, like if I had to think about it, like it's, like in one sense, you'd be thinking that the thing is sort of like an actor, and it's like, okay, I know,
yeah,
I know the subject that I now have to like assimilate and then pretend to be, or just because they're absorbed into them, they can just access that sort of like muscle memory of just like, how do I behave now? Because this is what that person would do.
Yeah, and I wonder if they even have access to possibly their actual memories, because now I have to watch the movie again just to see, do they ever call anyone by name without having somebody else say the name before them? Because yeah. Actually, that's another just a little tangent. That's another thing that completely helps me in this movie is that like I never get a full busload, like it's just like a dump of names where it's just like, hi, I'm this person, I'm this person, I'm this person, you know, like the Snow White meeting the Seven Dwarves all at once. It's that you literally get the names scene after scene. Like you never get more than maybe two at a time. So it is very, and they get repeated a lot. So you get, you
and
really
everyone's
know
just referring the movie, to them by their surname. Names. So you don't really,
yeah.
The only person whose first name we know is R.J. MacCready.
And right.
That's it. There might have been someone else. I'm pretty sure like everyone else is just, you just get their last names.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, okay. So, but in terms of, you mentioned a little earlier, the whole consciousness and whether they're conscious. What I always attributed that to when I saw particularly Nulls, but even like when the rest of them would look nervous, because I would be nervous in that situation, because I think because you don't know, there's often the speculation of, shit, what if I am infected and I don't even know it? Like, do these people know? That said, as an outsider, you know, or a moviegoer, what I perceive is that once the thing has replicated you, it knows exactly what it is.
Yeah.
You're not walking around thinking you are that person.
Yeah. Well, and that brings up like another theory that I think is bullshit. Again, is the one of that the whiskey at the end that he gives to Palmer, or not Palmer, sorry, Childs, is gasoline, because they were, and this is based on the fact that they were throwing around Molotov cocktails in like the JMB bottles, and you don't actually see MacCready drink from that bottle. He just kind of like goes with his blanket and goes and sits down, and then Childs comes over and he hands it to him, and Childs drinks. And that's when MacCready kind of like laughs, and people interpret that to mean that was a test. Now I'm doing like an Indian screen, like that was a test and you failed. But cause it was like, as Childs, like if Childs is the thing, like that theory is that like, he wouldn't know what whiskey tastes like. So he's drinking gasoline and being like, yeah, that tastes pretty good. And I don't buy that. And another thing is, like, people are saying that we know, or like, he's a thing because he's wearing a different coat than the one that he wears throughout the movie. But it's like, no, it's the same coat. It just has frost on it. So it looks like it's gray rather than blue.
We're living in an age of HD when you can actually see, oh, that's not a different pattern.
There's a lot of things that like people have invented to sort of like justify these theories. And and another one that I've seen like brought up again, and this is based on the 2011 movie. So I don't actually consider here because that didn't exist yet, but it's just like the inorganic material, not being able to be replicated by the thing, because we see that Childs has the earring in his one ear. Mm-hmm. I think that they're both human at the end. There's no, I mean, apparently John Carpenter has gone on record to say that one of them is the thing at the end, but I've also heard him go on record to say that it's supposed to be left ambiguous. So it's more about the ambiguity of it. You've got a theory?
Yeah, I agree. I had, oh, I don't, I don't have
I've
one.
Got
I've
a
heard
theory.
One.
What is your theory?
Oh my gosh, once more with feeling. Yes. I'm going to get that song in my head. Don't do that. Okay. Buffy, folks. Anyway. It's the fact that, not the fact, but I heard a theory at one point about the ending, and it had to do with the bottle. But it was also, again, like, apparently they do say it is canon within this movie that all it, or they, and it's, but it is canon, but it's also just speculation. Apparently all it needs is a few particles in order to, you know, imitate or copy or replicate itself and everything like that.
Yeah. Like once the cells get inside you, they can just latch onto your human cells
whatever.
And then just like assimilate you that way.
Which is like, well, then it's taken an awful lot of trouble to, I don't know. There are some scenes that I feel like, I don't know if they necessarily negate that. Like, see, all of this speculation is and this discussion is really making me just want to watch the movie again.
Yeah.
But the thing that I heard, the theory that I heard was that MacReady was handing the bottle to Childs because MacReady was infected and wanted to get Childs, you know, DNA or bacteria or whatever particles. And once Childs drank, the MacReady replicant had it, and now it's just a matter of time. Like, now he can take his time, kill Childs, and replicate him in well, all the time like, in the world. So when the rescue team comes, then they can infect the Earth.
I mean, it goes back to the like the first scene that you already mentioned where we're introduced to MacReady, where he gives the scotch to the chess computer.
Yes.
Like, pours it in there. So it's almost like that was his way to kind of beat the game in the end, is to give it to him. So, I mean, you could look at that in two ways. You could look at it as like, yeah, he was infected and he was now infecting the last human member, which would have been Childs. Or maybe he wasn't infected and he was giving that to Childs as again, another test. It didn't, it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be gasoline. It's just the fact that his saliva is on the bottle and he's now given it to Childs and Childs should be smart enough to know, I'm not going to accept this drink from you because of this. So it was almost like it was telling in that way that it's just like his laughter there was more of just like, I know you're not human, but we're fucked anyway. Because that's what they said. It doesn't matter what happens to us now because we're not getting out of here alive. That's kind of the ending for you. All they needed was the like a Collective Soul song to play over the
No, I actually that's why I prefer to like kind of believe that, or at least leave it ambiguous that there's a chance that they're both still human, because it's almost like this movie's answer to Casablanca for me, where like Claude Rains and Humphrey Bogart are walking up just like, this could be the start of a beautiful friendship, you know. I would love to think that this is just like what kind of like brings MacReady and Childs together, to actually see they have much more in common than they ever acknowledged during the runtime of the movie. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's another movie to follow where, you know, there's still, see, that's
well,
that's the movie I would watch. I would watch a Thing sequel where MacReady and Childs are still around and uninfected.
Okay. Well, okay. That's a good segue into this next thing. Cause there's that opens like a lot of things that I want to talk about. First off is there's a video game, which is a sequel to the movie, but I mean, it obviously you can't really consider that to be canon. I remember I owned it at one time, like when it came out, like it was a PC game. So it was quite old because it would have been like early 2000s. And I never got far enough into it to get to this. But I know that I think that the canon in the game was that MacReady had turned into the Thing. And I don't remember if Childs had survived or not. But like we do know, like I'm sure you've known about it, but they are rebooting the Thing at some point.
Yeah. Coming up.
Blumhouse, so that's kind of a red flag for me. But
we'll see.
That aside, have you heard anything like any new information about that? Like, what do you know?
Okay, not at all. Nothing.
All I know is that it's going to follow the source material more closely. It's going to be they're using the novella called Who Goes There, or actually it was like there was another book that was sort of an extension of that, and I forget, I think it was Frozen Hell or something. I could be wrong. I'll look it up. So I think that's the source material that they're using for it. So I don't know if that's going to be a sequel or a requel, or I guess there's nothing to requel because we don't have any canon in between that, unless you're considering the video game. But I mean, in that case, like, how would you feel about like Kurt Russell starring sequel taking place? I mean, obviously not 40 years later, because that should have been coming out this year if it was going to be a 40th anniversary. What would you want to see? Because you did mention the potentiality of a sequel.
Yeah, no, what I'd actually would love to see, because as far as I'm concerned, I don't mind if MacReady's there. I'd actually, because I love Kurt Russell and, you know, it's the spirit of the piece. But MacReady got to take up so much space in the first movie. Childs is the one that I would really, really like to see handle the situation. And at least, if not be a member of the crew that is initially heading down there, you know, can kind of like zoom in and like the 11th hour.
He can be the, he can be the 2018 Laurie Strode of the movie.
Exactly. That's what
waited,
I wanted to be.
I've waited
for
this my whole life.
I've waited over 40 years. So
podcasters will like come to his like house to and be like, what do you want? We want to pay you for an interview.
My payment. We're podcasters. We're investigative journalists. Anyway, we'll talk about
that
when we do
in okay, so in that vein, so you are completely against the 2011 movie doing a prequel.
Okay.
Because I am. I am. Yeah. I well, don't like that at all.
Okay, this is the thing. The thing. Mm-hmm. This is the thing. You already mentioned like how smart it was, and I agree, for them to open ambiguously and really for them to put us in the position of the people from the American institution just because, or the institute, not institution, sorry, yeah. The American Institute, just because we are going to be learning things at the same rate they are. Mm-hmm. We have no exposure. We have or limited exposure. Like, we have a little bit more info than they do, but we don't know exactly what went down and how and when. It's all speculatory. Yeah. So, to go back as those characters to the Norge station and behold all of that, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you see what you're up against. I think that's immensely powerful. So, I think maybe the reboot could have been more successful because it is also capitalizing on our knowledge, mostly, if you've seen the original, mm-hmm. or not the original, but, you know, the 1982 movie of The Thing, and you see the prequel, you already know what The Thing is capable of. Yeah. So it kind of goes hand in hand in that vein. The problem is I have so many issues with the decisions they made that I will not go into on this pod.
Yeah.
But just with the decisions they made for like how things went down, it is so much more horrifying and dark in my imagination mm-hmm. witnessing the aftermath than it is watching that damn movie.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, yeah, this movie, 1982, starts off in the middle of a story that we didn't need to get any more information. Like, we got everything we needed to know about the threat, whereas the 2011 one, and this is why I really just hate prequels in general. Like, prequels to me are the lowest form of any sort of franchise continuation, because you're just, you're taking a story that's already been told properly, like more successfully, less is more. And that's what 2011 does the opposite of by, okay, well, now we're going to go back and we're going to show all this stuff. And that's lazy writing, for one thing, because it's like you already have the movie written. You just need to like put all the fine details. So I think that there's like a lot of stuff happening in that movie, but none of it is ever particularly interesting or, you know, or like advancing the plot. And it's, you know, even at, I mean, effects aside and like, you know, which is just an insult, but it's like nothing new is learned. And we don't know what happens to Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character at the end of that. So it's just like, you're just creating another question mark that is never going to get answered at any point. So, I mean, it did introduce new lore, which, I mean, I would be fine if it was never canon, even though the idea of inorganic material not being able to be replicated does make sense scientifically.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I can accept that as canon if it's established in a sequel. But it's just like, why, when you have this property and you're given the opportunity to make it like a continuation of it, what, even if it was like a remake, like, who? I mean, I don't know if I would have liked a remake better in this case, because I don't want to see someone like playing Kurt Russell again. You know, I think that would have been stupid, but I just feel like it was such a mistake. And not only that, but the, I think that because they kind of, they framed it like it was going to be a twist. Because when you see the same thing that they bring back, like the two-headed, like melded together, that's kind of like when you're clued in, oh, this is that, that's how that came about. But I mean, like at the beginning of the movie, you get the title card where it's just like Antarctica 1982. So you're just like, oh, okay, so this is a prequel. So yeah, it, I don't think that that movie succeeded in doing anything other than kind of reminding people that there's a much better movie out there, and and then like halting any growth moving forward for, I guess, at least 11 years now, because, or you know, more, because we don't know when or if or when this movie is even eventually going to happen.
I concur. And also, have we mentioned Rob Bottin's name yet? I don't know, but I'm gonna mention it because Rob Bottin and his team, the work on this movie, I mean, talk about memorable, talk about impactful, talk about, like, even if you're not wincing at the gore, you know, which I don't think is really the intention. It is, you know, it does have this wonderful kind of otherworldly, fantastical quality to it that is almost like it could border on very elevated funhouse, you know? Like,
I mean, I think when people think of practical effects, generally, like, this is going to be the first movie that springs to mind.
Yes. And for me to watch it as a child and be fascinated by it and scared of it. I remember I always got sad when Jed was led into the pen with the other Malamutes and Huskies, because I knew what was going to come, yet I could not look away, and I still can't. I don't, this is one instance where I don't mask my eyes, because I want to see every exquisite moment of the work that they have done, and it's not easy. I make a face, and I do, you know, like back up and tense up and everything like that, but, it's also just so incredibly, I mean, I was thinking while I was watching it this particular time, I articulated the thought to myself, like, how inventive is that to, like, have someone, like, punch through someone's chest while you're trying to revive them with, you know, the electric paddles, and then to have the chest cavity for that is now broken form teeth that chomp the hands off of Copper, who is trying to revive the person, and immediately just like go to town, start like replicating. Come on, we got to make this happen, people. And even to the point where you think that everyone in the room while that is happening can see that Norris's head is detaching and on the floor, when that's not what they're trying to handle. They're dealing with a whole other thing at the other end of the room. So when it starts to just scurry off and we get, you know, Palmer's incredible line, you gotta be fucking kidding me. it's just...
You gotta be fucking kidding me.
Yay! But just the... Yeah, I mean, just the fact that that little essence of it is just like an afterthought, and then all of a sudden they're all just beholding it. Okay, set it on fire. I just, and also the fact that it assumes this weird insect-like or crab-like, you know, kind of like, you know,
spider
form. Yeah. It could be any of them. It just seems like they're all.
Makes you wonder, like, guessing. What is like going on in like biologically inside of. Their body, like, once through the thing. It's just like, I just imagine like an amusement park of like tentacles and like slime just like spinning around in there. I did, well, just because you mentioned the scene, I do also want to, because I'll forget about it later, is in that moment, just the misdirection like from Carpenter, because you have Clark, who's like picked up the scalpel, and we're focused on the scalpel and him holding the scalpel, because it's like right in the forefront of the shot, and you're not expecting the chest cavity to open up when they're hitting with the paddles at all. So very successful directing and misdirection there. But I did want to point out something, because you mentioned the kennel scene, and that was actually special effects by Stan Winston.
Oh, that was? Oh, okay.
Yeah, so...
I forgot. I think I knew that and I forgot.
No, but for anyone listening, because, like, Rob Bottin really had, like, a huge workload with this movie that he was not able to do, like, on time or all by himself. So Stan Winston came on, and he did this work for him, and he said, you know what, I want to remain uncredited, because Rob Bottin was very new to the scene at the time, and he wanted to make sure that he received all the credit for the movie. Oh. And the kennels, like, the effects in that scene are remarkable, but, like, that's not to take away from, like, the effects that we see in every other part of this movie, like, especially, like, the Norris head, that, as you mentioned, like, as it's not even just, like, the legs sprouting out of it, but, like, the green slimy thing as it's, like, slowly falling off the side of the table there.
Yes.
And then, of course, the Blair thing at the end, with basically, like, every iteration of the thing kind of popping out of it, or just, like, there's, like, the Uber thing, I don't know what to call it, of just, like, the amalgamation of everything. And I also, and I think, like, probably when the effects are at their worst might be in that scene, and I'm just talking about, like, the miniatures that they use, like, the miniature models. And even then, I watch that, I'm just like, that is so cool, like, that they that they made, like, shot part of the movie with miniatures like that. Because even though it doesn't, like, you know, if you are watching it on Blu-ray or 4K, you like, notice, like, okay, this looks a little shoddy, but it's still, like, you, like, for 1982, it, like, it's super impressive.
Yeah. And if you're not looking for that and you're just riding the wave, then... Yeah. Because also, Palmer's reveal, too. My God. Like, after he gives that reaction that I love so much. And then you just see that face. And even just, like, when his fingers are going... I'm sorry, I'm jumping around.
It's like a Venus flytrap. Or, yeah, Blair, the hand into the Gary's hand, face. Yeah, that's Gary's really well face. Done. And then pulling him... with the, and just like the skin kind of like, so gross.
Terrible. So great. Yeah. So fucking great. That said, okay, I do have one criticism for this movie. Mm. And it's just, it is actually like, maybe it's just a pacing thing. And I've said this about other John Carpenter movies every now and then. I'm just kind of like, okay, I didn't need, from the point where they blow up Blair's little cabin.
Yeah.
To Blair's reappearance. I nod off a little bit. I always check out. It's not a lot of screen time. It's a collection of minutes. But I do tend to kind of, I start noticing my mind wandering. And I start, and I'm speculating about, usually about other things that have been happening in the movie that I, you know, notice for the first time. I'm just kind of like, I wonder what that. But it is like, it is just like a little kind of like pit stop for me in the movie.
I actually agree.
It's the only criticism.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's not really a criticism for me, but I do think that it's, it's like there's a lot of loose ends and we only have so much time to wrap them up in that I feel like a lot of it's being glossed over. It's just like, you still have all these people still alive. We got to get rid of them. And again, like another anticlimactic end for a character with Nulls who just kind of walks off and disappears. So we never like definitively see what happens to him. Although it can be assumed that he died, but it does feel like, it's from that point on where they're like, we're going to like heat things up here. That it's just like, okay, now the movie's on autopilot for a bit. And actually one criticism I have, I don't even know if it's a criticism, but I just felt like there could have been a better written line for MacReady when he throws the dynamite at the thing. Cause I mean like, I do like, yeah, fuck you too. Cause I mean like, I would probably say that in the moment, but I just like, you could, I was just thinking like, you could have been more clever than that. Like, come on.
But then you run the risk of like, you know, straddling too, the genres of like horror and action, be more actiony than horror. And also maybe just more hokey.
Maybe he didn't even have to say anything at all. He could have just been like,
Maybe he could just be like,
it's not even, it's
just like, fuck, and just thrown it.
Fuck you.
Full of Jamie Kennedy. That would have been great. Oh my God.
It's not even a gripe. I just like, it is something that always like, it's distracting. We'll say that.
And I feel like this movie does dodge a lot of moments where it could go full action. Like one of the things I loved, I never noticed it before, but it's after MacReady punches out Blair in the, in the office where he's going crazy and beating up poor Windows and everything. And, they all just kind of seize on Blair and MacReady's throwing the punches and taking him out. And finally he's unconscious. And the first thing I see Kurt Russell do when he gets back up is he goes, you know, just like waves his hand, yeah. like shakes it, like, oh, fuck my hand. And I'm like, that is so non, that's so not an action hero move, yeah. you know? Like the only people you ever see do that in action movies are the women when they throw punches yeah. because we live in a misogynist, you know, society. But
I also noticed like during that shot as well, when they're, cause they're kind of like, I guess there's a pile of them on top
yes,
of Blair.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, like, I think it's MacReady who like pulls Fuchs out of there, and I don't even know yeah. Fuchs was underneath, and he sort of like falls backwards, like he's like fainting.
Yes, yes.
And that shot always like jumps out at me because it's just like, A, when was Fuchs even like in there, and B, like right. he was just like, it's like he probably got hit by MacReady like by accident because he was just like in such close maybe. Proximity.
Because you're right, I didn't even articulate it to myself, but it looks like he gets the vapors for those. Oh, bug of stars, you know, or something like that. But, and I'm just like, what's up with Fuchs? But then, you know, the action's yeah. going, so you got to pay attention to more stuff. Also, one of my other, like, there are wonderful little laughing moments in this movie, throughout this movie for me, but one of the things that always makes me laugh because of the sadness that mm-hmm. I feel when I watch it mm-hmm. is Blair in his cabin when MacReady goes to check on him after they've already, you know, locked him in and everything. He comes back and he opens up the little, you know, window and stuff. He's just sitting there just like, I'm feeling much better. There's some hearing things out here. He's doing all that. And the noose is hanging right by him. And he's telling that's him like, not no,
the, that, yeah, that's not the words of somebody who's in their right mind to have fashioned a noose.
I mean, and I love just the visual image of it because it's a tableau.
I'm all better
and
if now. It were, I'm all yeah, if it,
even if it were without the wonderful lines and the wonderful line delivery, if it were just like a tableau, like a painting yeah. that I were looking at of just like the room, and I just saw a man sitting there with that expression on his face with a noose right next to him, and it could be entitled "I feel much better now." You know, I would just
it's
tell
like
myself
a comic
like,
strip.
Okay. yeah, right. It's like what are they call it, the Far Side or yeah. whatever, yeah, like one of those, but one of those dark humor comics. But one thing that I love about it is it speaks volumes to me is that like I do think he's feeling better than he was, certainly, but I also think he's do you make anything of that particular image, like the noose and why it's there?
Canon is that I think that Blair, because like we see that there's different types of infections, because yes. there's two instances where there are shredded pajamas that are found. Yes. The first is when Knowles brings it in, and he's just like, yes. "Which one of you are disrespecting my kitchen?"
Yeah, right.
And they look at it and they can't see the names. But then like, yeah, but then later on, after like the 48 hours have gone by of the storm. And MacReady is doing the dictation, and he says, Windows found some pajamas or shredded long johns. So that tells us that, well, that's someone else's shredded long johns. And if, like, going by that, okay, so we knew that, like, Norris and Palmer were infected. And Blair, he's still wearing the same outfit. Like, he still has his long johns on. Like, later when he appears behind Gary, you know, the whole, like, yeah. and shh. So we know that like if he was infected, he probably would have been assimilated like by like some sort of transference, like they put it in his food because they were bringing food out to him. So I think that maybe he had them of like, who knows like how long infection takes place, like if it's done that, like if you absorb the thing like cells, then maybe he's just like, it, you know, might be like zombification, like you know that you're becoming one. So he might have just like to prepare, like made the noose, and it was too late. Like it had already, it, like suddenly taken over his brain that there was no coming back. So that's what I made of that.
That's interesting. Oh no, especially like
it was like it was just like thing Blair thinking like, oh, I'm gonna just show that like I'm losing my shit out here because I want to come back in. That right. I'm going to, like, put this noose here is, like, almost like a threat that, like, if you leave me out here, I'm going to hang myself. Which, like, totally works against his psychology of saying, like, I'm all better now. You can trust me.
But also, if they see this, they may not let me out, and I may get to go back to work on my little ship, you know? Like,
maybe yeah, just, like, leave me alone. Like, he doesn't want to be bothered.
Right. That's hilarious. But I also never thought, you brought up the food, and I always paid attention when Fuchs talked about like them eating out of cans to like, you know, limit the mm-hmm. exposure that, you know, to distribute food and like cook and like have, you know, big communal things, you know, just have people responsible for their own stuff and everything like that. I never thought about the fact they were bringing meals to Blair, and that could be a way mm-hmm. of like passing the infection. I honestly never thought of that. That's fascinating mm-hmm. because what I perceived was, and I'm not signing my name on this. I'm just saying, as I watched the movie, I always suspected that Blair might not yet be infected. Something may, but he's hearing the weird things and everything like that. So he knows his time is coming. And like the premonitory suicide that we saw with the slashing of the throat and of the wrists and everything, that froze at the Norge station. Mm-hmm. I think that he was creating an out for himself. Granted, the noose is very low to the ground, so I don't know exactly how that would work.
I thought
it was just him, like an in case of emergency kind of, you know, fail.
Maybe it was like his like wait, because he had. And this is why I think like he was already long gone at that point, because he had dug into like underneath the thing and built this entire spaceship, which is not going to, I mean, even in a 48 hour time frame, like imagine doing all that work. But maybe the noose was like sort of like just to like harness himself up, like, you know, out of the hole.
Oh, maybe.
Now we're just getting like way too far into.
No, but I love it. I love it. I would love to actually see an interview with Bell Lancaster, who wrote the screenplay, and just mm-hmm. find out like, what did he think was going on? Did he actually work to solve, you know, like where, who would be where and what and when, and where would the passage, where would the transference be, you know, taking place? Or did he just kind of like write it ambiguously and just kind of go like, you know, you have fun, kids, you figure it out.
I'm glad that it is. I'd rather it be ambiguous than like full of plot holes.
Sure.
Because, you know, it's way more fun to figure out through ambiguity than sort of defend error in continuity.
Yeah. That's true.
But I'm of the opinion that it was all just like, we're going to make it as ambiguous as possible.
Yeah.
You did mention lines. I want to mention one more line that I liked from Gary, actually. and it's right at the end, like in that scene that you claim is super boring and you nod off.
Not my words.
Just
but
kidding.
Go on.
Just kidding. When McCready is like, "How's that generator looking?" or whatever he says, and Gary's like, "It's gone," and they're like, "What?" And he's like, "It's gone, McCready."
Yes.
He has so many good, like, even like when they come out of the or like out of the pit or the hole underneath the cabin, he's like, "What do we do? What do we do?" Because it's going back to what you were saying about him, like he's like, he's fully in control, but now that he's sort of like relinquished that, he's now like, "I need help."
Yes. I'm not going to pretend that I know what's going on or what's the best thing to do. But I do like that about him. But I also love just it's one of the funny little kind of like metaphorical manifestations in the movie. I love that when Windows, like, I think he gets the axe from behind the glass, right? When he loses it, when he finally just cracks.
No, he gets a gun or like.
Oh, it was a gun.
Yeah.
It was a gun. I remember. Yeah. Okay, now I remember. Because there were axes like planted at the other station, and then I noticed, oh, there's an axe in the American station. I'm thinking it's getting late, and I'm just mixing things up. Anyway, when Windows grabs the gun, whatever, he breaks the glass. I just wrote this sentence in my notes: "Windows breaks when the windows break." I really appreciate it. It's actually like
I mean, going back to our last podcast, it's just you know, it's like it's okay to break. So maybe that was like, that was Windows. That's why he's called Windows, because he breaks.
I always just thought it was like, because
if he was Sidney Prescott, that's when he would turn them in like, "I'm not glass, McCready. You don't have to treat me like, or, you know, whatever."
Yeah, right. Just be like,
but in that moment, because this is another interesting thing that's sort of hidden in there, because there's this huge mystery of who got to the blood, who sabotaged
yes,
the blood.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because the only two people, well, what they say, they keep saying is that the only two people who could have gotten it are either Gary or Copper, because Copper has yeah. access to it, or is the only one that does mm-hmm. access it, but Gary has the only key, which means that as the chain of yeah. command, Copper has to go to Gary and get the key. And in that moment yeah. of hysteria, because you have to remember that Bennings was just killed and, you know, nobody knew what was going on, that yeah. they're all being like, well, like, who else could have done it? He's like, I don't know. Like, maybe someone could have lifted it off of me. And then that's when Childs is like, oh, bullshit. Like, no one's believing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that moment, that's before Windows runs off and breaks the glass. And he's looking, he's like, uh-huh. oh, no. Like, and getting all nervous. Yeah. And that's when he runs out, because he knows that he was the last one that had the keys. Because in the scene previous to that, when they're in the, when they're moving all this, like, the body into the storeroom, he's yeah. like, do you have the keys? And Bennings is like, no, go get them from Gary. And then that's when he leaves and the thing assimilates Bennings, and he comes back and is just like, all right, let's finish up here, and sees the assimilation happening. And then you hear him drop the keys on the floor, and then he runs out mm-hmm. to MacCready and Fuchs. So whoever sabotaged the blood in that moment got the keys, or it might have even been after the fact, because the keys were lost in the shuffle and then somehow were returned to Gary. But that all happened in, like, all the chaos that they don't remember. So that's why, like, Windows in that moment is having that reaction that he does of just, like, going out and breaking yeah. the gun cabinet to get the gun out, because he knows that, like, there's a chance that they might remember that it was him and then point the finger at him for being the thing.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah,
very good.
Like, I love, like, the layers.
Yeah, I have nothing more to offer. That was so incredibly thorough.
That's the thing. Like, this is, because, you know, we were talking, you mentioned this, like, when we did Get Out, and you're just like, how yeah. you had no intention of just, like, or desire to watch a perfect movie, you know? And I kind of started, like, last night, because I didn't fall asleep. I knew that I was getting tired. I'm like, I'm going to pause this, and I'm going to finish it tomorrow. So I watched the rest today. But I definitely was of that mindset. Like, I don't know if I have, like, the willpower to watch this, because it is such a big movie that I don't think I could give it my attention right now. Because this is a perfect movie. This is a 5-star movie. And I mean, you say that you're ready to jump back in and watch it again. I'd already given myself a year and a half, and I feel like I could have gone longer, because it's like, I don't want to ruin this movie by overexposing myself to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I agree. Mm-hmm. I understand. I have that same feeling with other particular projects. This one, because I watched it often. I think I watched it maybe almost weekly, if not daily, for at least a year of my single digit life, you know, when I was in grade school. And, then didn't watch it for a long, long time. I think the next time I watched it, I did rent, like, whatever collector's edition DVD was released, whether it was, like, late 90s or when I was working at a video store from 2000 to 2002. Mm-hmm. But I remember revisiting it and being really happy. And then I didn't watch it again I watched it in anticipation of the prequel. And because I wanted to get all the references, and it wasn't as fresh in my head as it was, because I think I watched it almost too young. Like, I remember images and I remember noises. I don't remember so much scenes. You know what I mean? So that's why I always forget that it begins the way it begins, because I do space it out. I don't watch it, like, even every Halloween or anything. I think in discussion with you and with Fright Club and with, you know, the pod from the past and everything, I think I've watched it probably the most consistently since grade school, since I've met you. And nothing to compare with grade school, though. Like, I can't do those numbers. I don't have that time.
Yeah.
This one is definitely, I don't know if I would put it top five, because I don't, like I said, I don't think I watch it often enough for it to be, like, top five. Like, but I do adore it. I do feel like it's a remarkable piece of work, and I feel an absolute sense of satiation, cinematic, you know, satisfaction when it's all over.
Yeah.
Like those credits roll. I actually had my mom watch it because she hadn't seen it since I was a child.
Oh, yeah.
This most recent screening. And she sat there and once the credits started going at the end, she was like, that's it? You know, with that vast kind of like, wow, you know, tone of voice. And we talked about it afterwards. And it was, yeah, it's a wonderful movie to share with people too. Like, yeah. I would love to screen this for more people and just see what they think. So yeah. Good nice. Movie. Good movie.
All right. Well, yeah. I think that we can move on to the cherry picker then. So first order of business, do we have a cherry on top? Because there are so many characters, like I said, like, I like everyone in this movie. Like, that's the thing. It's going to be hard to pick a favorite and pick, like, a person to die. I want to hear what you have to say first, because I offered a suggestion last time and you shot it down.
I shot it down
because it wasn't quite cherry on top enough for you. So it wasn't
not in the face of like the person who we ended up electing. So yeah. Like that, because I so, but in this particular case, I feel like the cherry on top for me, I've already mentioned how much I want to see him in a sequel or a requel.
Yeah,
it's Childs. He's a vital character. I feel like this movie loses a lot if he's not present. And even if like somebody else kind of like is there to kind of like be, you know, in his spot, not say his lines, not behave the way he does, but to be like kind of like the other last man standing, it doesn't have the same, it needs to be MacReady and Childs at the end. And he's such a vital part. And I enjoy Keith David's performance so fucking much.
It's
I would grant it to him.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, it's one or the other. So it's really hard to kind of to single one of them out. But okay. I just think, in the sake of being, you know, taking the path less traveled, I might agree with you and say that Childs is the cherry on top. And especially for that line that we still can't determine.
Yeah, it could be anything. I don't, he could be just making noises, just engine noises. I mean, yes.
Yeah.
More of that.
All right, so yeah, there we go. Now to the cherry picker. Last week we asked you who deserves to die the most in Scream 2. I nominated film class guy number one.
Yes.
And Eddie, you nominated drama teacher Gus Gold.
Yes.
Across Patreon, Instagram, and YouTube, 347 for film class guy number one versus 207 for drama teacher Gus Gold.
That's a lot of votes.
There is a lot of, I mean, it's both of Scream. Us. It's, you know, everyone wants to chime in on Scream. So let's read what some of the comments are
saying. Curious, my God.
Sarah Campbell says, Gus Gold not believing Sydney when she tells him she's a fighter is just as bad as moving the headstones and not moving the bodies. I'm with Eddie on this one. My vote is for Gus.
That Why? Is remarkable.
Why?
I love that.
There should have been like an epilogue at the end of Scream 2 where Gus walks into the theater and everything's destroyed. Right. And it's just like, what happened here? And Sydney just like runs up to him and starts shaking him. And she's just like,
yeah, right. You wouldn't cancel the play. Yeah, you wouldn't cancel Cassandra. You wouldn't cancel Cassandra. Why? I'm never gonna forget that now. Thank you so much.
that's the true ending of that we needed for Scream 2. Not that overhead shot of
yeah, right. yes, give it to me.
Howell Puns says the lack of health and safety on that entire Cassandra production is reason enough. Also, assuming the onstage ghost face is real, there is no way he didn't see that then, sorry, there's no way he didn't see that, period. Then he's all, everyone take five, like someone didn't just attack your lead with a knife. Girl, please.
That is a tremendous point if you are a believer that Ghostface is actually so is on that, that stage.
Does that sway your opinion then? If it goes towards discrediting
Ghost? I still don't think Ghostface is on there. I still don't think Mickey or Mrs. Loomis are on there. But I do think if he were, then it only helps my case. So you're helping my case, Zach Cherry, by believing that Ghostface is actually on that stage.
Howell Puns is helping your case. But DP says, I say Gus because it would make a great set piece and an homage to the principal being killed in the original.
Oh my God. I mean, that is true.
Yeah, you could have added a body to the
to the pile,
to the kill count, yeah,
with, to the with that character pile.
Not to say that, because obviously there was more deaths in this movie than the original, but I don't know. I heard someone else, they told me, and I forget who it was, so I'm sorry, but they said that they personally headcanoned that film class guy number one is the same character that we see in Urban Legend. He eventually does get his comeuppance there. And then I also, and then I had mentioned, well, maybe that means that sorority sister Lois is also the killer and goes off because she first came to Windsor College and then was planning to kill a bunch of people. And then it's just like, oh, Ghostface has already claimed this territory. Okay, I'm going to go to Windsor.
Because of ethics, like when you're a murderer, sure.
Yeah, it's like there's like an unspoken code. It's just like
all Dexter.
All killers they respect each other's turf, and it's just like, oh, you got this. Already. Okay, I'm gonna go to Pendleton.
Otherwise, you get a Freddy versus Jason kind of scenario. And where you got Freddy
we do
and
not.
Lake
yeah,
or...
yeah, we don't need another Freddy versus Jason. Blue Box 87 asks, what are these choices? Can't wait to listen to the app. I refuse to pick David Warner. Film class great. Guy, I guess. Okay. There are choices, you know, like what was our Scream 1 choices were even more ridiculous. I said blood to red guy. You said girl.
The girl in the video store.
Looking for the
movie with E.T.'s mom. The werewolf movie with E.T.'s mom.
Yeah.
Because that's more
their choices,
and also because we enjoy the characters of Scream 2 entirely too much to kill them off. Even the ones who I don't enjoy to the degree that other people do, like a Mickey, I don't want him to die.
And film class guy number one and Gus Gould, drama teacher, still they meet the criteria of nomination. Mm-hmm. So
exactly, you know, and they irk me.
We can kill them.
Not film class guy. I love Joshua Jackson. I'd watch him do anything. But anyway, go on. Any more?
Yes. Mendejo says, looks like I got to rewatch Scream 2. Have no clue who these two are. I've grown senile at 22 already. Well, we're happy to throw you for a loop.
There
with those options. G3 says, you should stop putting whose pick it... Okay, yeah, we've been through this. You should stop putting whose pick it is just to make it more fair for Eddie. I feel like people are going to pick Zach more just because they most likely come from the Zach Cherry channel. We talked about this last week. This was brought up. But I mean, like, I just want to point out that, you know, I'm collecting... like the data that comes from Instagram as well, and my Patreon. This was actually just to break down the vote. It was 12-9 on Patreon for film class guy number one. So you still a lot of people were voting for Gus. Instagram was 72-57 in favor of film class guy number one. But there has been times on Instagram where I think even last week. It might have been split equal. I know that there's times where the vote is more swayed in your favor on Instagram. And it's just like, these are people coming from my Instagram account too.
Yeah.
And then YouTube was 263 to 141. But I mean, like, this channel is both of us. Like, if you are watching it on YouTube, so it's not like there is no bias. Like, if you're thinking biasedly, that might have more to do with you. Not to call out G3, but I'm just saying, like, we want you to vote for whoever you want. Don't vote for you're not voting for us as people.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we want to own our nomination. We want our name to be behind it because, you know,
vote your heart. Yeah.
Or vote with your, just don't, you know. And we have very different ways of how we approach things too. Like I've noticed that you pick things more so based on emotionally, we'll say. Whereas I might pick mine more logically in terms of okay, well, this person sucks because of that.
Right.
So, and it's not that I don't agree with what you're saying in terms of that. But
you have your decision and I have mine. And somebody always gets to pick first too. So sometimes if we have the same decision, we can't.
Yeah.
Make it,
you could. Know? Yeah. Like you could win one, like you could win this cherry picker and you could go on a tear and win them like every week consecutively.
I agree. Yeah,
but I mean, like I said, like I know a bitch when I see one and I think sometimes you miss the finer details.
But also I gotta say, like, I mean, you do have like a broader following than I do. If there is anything to the argument, it's not something that affects me personally. I'm not gonna sit here and be like, they just don't like me. I'm just gonna be like, well, I mean, even if they are, like, that's their right. They can vote any way they damn well please. And if they wanna back you, that is their right as well. And I am not angry about it. It's not that deep, guys.
I'm not crying. I don't get angry. When I don't get the votes either, it's for jokes.
That's not gonna change. Guys.
We're gonna continue to have our names represented next to our nominations. Yeah. Anyway, real quick to get through the rest of these comments. Green Hair 77 says Joshua Jackson. Thomas Baker says I keep Gus. That's it. And then Jake Bloomfield says none of them. Which is not an answer, or not
that's
an option.
Not a choice.
Yeah, you gotta pick one.
That vote doesn't count.
So, having said that, since I'm the winner of this round, my nomination is going to be Blair.
Okay.
Because we'll see where you go. And I have a feeling I know. But I just, like, with Blair, I just, like I said previously, I don't like his knee-jerk response to everything. Like, he flies off the handle way too quickly. He doesn't go about it in a very practical or intellectual matter. He's causing physical harm that could kill people. Like, I don't know what he did with that axe, but, like, we see windows with, like, cuts on him. He fired a gun at McCready and Childs separately. Yes. Like, he was just he basically fucked them all over by doing that. You know, there might have been a possibility to contain the thing had they not destroyed all of their resources, or had he not done it. So he kind of fucked them over, and it was all for naught, because, you know, we see where things went, and it only put them at an even greater disadvantage. And there's going to be a sequel at some point. So clearly his efforts did not do anything.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on. Let me look real quick.
You've got there's 13 other choices in this movie.
I can't remember if this.
Also, I should point out that we are not. You can't. Okay. We're voting for we have to nominate the person as the person. We can't nominate them based on their attributes after being assimilated into the thing.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. Oh, I mean,
but just for the listeners.
Yeah, people are going to vote on who they're going to vote on. But okay. I'm going to ask a question because I didn't go over the rules for this. Because it just suddenly occurred to me, like, there's someone who I don't want. I have a secondary thing in case this doesn't work out. But yeah. Could I conceivably choose the Norwegian passenger with the rifle?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's one of the 13 choices that I said.
Okay.
The shot Norwegian or the one that blows up with the helicopter?
The shot one. Okay. The one who actually fires the rifle, screaming Norwegian words, you know, at the Americans and just begins shooting at them. Okay. Like they should know what's going on. Mm-hmm. I'm going to choose him just because I feel like, number one, he's a horrible shot. Number two, I understand I feel the tragedy of the language barrier, mm-hmm. you know, like being this impediment to, you know, what needing to get done, getting done and everything like that. But the plain fact of the matter is you can't go running onto other people's compounds shooting at anything and not expect pandemonium and to get, you know, like, I mean, because he hit an innocent man and he didn't hit the thing. And the guy who blows up is, you know, I mean, that was a dumb mistake too. That is a real stupid mistake. But I'd say in this day and age, it really, really bothers me watching somebody, you know, like run around with a gun, just kind of firing it off, screaming. I mean, if the roles were reversed, and it were an American soldier chasing after the dog and, you know, going on a Norwegian compound and firing a gun. I mean, oh, my God, the embarrassment I would feel for my country and for, you know, I would just. So, yeah, I think he like I understand the stakes and the panic and everything like that. That said, figure it out, buddy. Yeah. So kill him.
It's I mean, both of these nominations are kind of fueled by impulsive actions.
Recklessness.
Absolutely. Yeah. Also, I think, I don't know for sure, that character's name is Lars by virtue of what he's named in the prequel. I'll look into it. I'll probably end up just listing him as whatever IMDb says for his credit in this movie.
Yeah, it says Norwegian with rifle.
Yeah. But
Norwegian passenger with rifle.
Yeah, but there you have it. Vote your heart, vote your conscience. You can vote on the YouTube community section for the Cherry Picker. You can vote on Instagram at the Cherry Picker Pod, and you can also vote on Patreon if you support us there. Just want to welcome aboard some new Patreon supporters. So we've got quite a few. So hold up a second. We've got Marcus Rando, Silent Saturn, Dominic, Tim, Austin Daniel, Kiwar One, Sheena 6789, Andrew, and TJ Sanchez. So welcome aboard. We've got a lot of people who are ready for our bonus episode, the Cherry Picker After Dark, which is coming up next. I mean, it should, I believe, release-wise. Yeah, January 22nd. Or January. What month are we in? June 22nd. I'm thinking, well, it's the thing. I thought it was the middle of winter, you know. June 22nd, where we've got our first episode of the Cherry Picker After Dark, where we cover the topic of cursed films. That will be available on my Patreon account to the Freddy Krueger tier and above. So that's starting at $5 contribution monthly. You can check out the bonus episode. So we're running a bonus episode once a month. So something to take into consideration.
It's a good one.
It is.
The cursed films one is a good one.
They're all everything we do is good though.
Everything we do is great.
if you want to support on the lowest level on the $1 tier, that does get you the shout out like you just heard, and also you get early access to all of our regular episodes as well. Video and audio depending on how your absorbing the media. So if you are listening to the podcast, you can watch it on YouTube at the Cherry Picker. And if you are watching us on YouTube, the RSS feed link is in the descriptions down below. We do have a review.
Oh
yeah, another review on Apple Podcasts. So I'll just read that for you, dude. from Captain Chaz, dude. I thought your YouTube channel was great. This is amazing. You guys are so good together, and unlike most hosts, I never get annoyed. Keep it up.
Aww.
You say that now.
Yeah, you say that now. Like
until we are annoying.
Until we are, but you know what? Then we're family. Yeah. So welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. When you screamed, dude, that was the whole review, and I'm like, that is the greatest. But even what follows is even better.
Yeah. So thank you to Captain Chaz. Also, thank you to Andre for editing the podcast.
Yay, Andre, thank you.
Thank you. And what else we got? Where can people find you on social media?
Edward is Truth, one word, on Instagram and YouTube. I do some movie reactions. I had a little bit of a copyright claim issue, so what was not posted will be posted. And just watching a lot of movies in celebration of Pride. June 2022.
Yeah. Welcome to YouTube. Copyright claims galore. And you can find me on YouTube at my main channel, Zach Cherry. And I'm also on Instagram at Retro Bitch Face, all one word. And on Twitter at Zach Cherry 8. And of course, as mentioned previously, there is our joint Instagram account for the Cherry Picker at the Cherry Picker Pod.
Yes.
Eduardo, what have we got going on next week?
I forgot. Oh, right. It's that one with the kids and that guy with the, is it a hook?
It's a hook, yeah.
I'll have to watch it again to refresh my memory. It's a hook. I know what you did last summer.
Just in time for the 4th of July.
Hey!
check that out. I know that's a popular 90s slasher that that people love, but we'll get more into that next week. So thank you for watching, for listening, and we will be right back.